We're about to announce the secret surprise volunteer for the panel, and it's going to be one of the people that are still standing in the back of the room.
I think we ought to let Ed do it as a swan song.
Well, interesting you should mention Ed. Actually, a very interesting question, I think, came up in this morning's discussion, which is, why are people so reluctant to agree with Ed Trott? I can't help but ribbing Ed just a little bit here. I just wanted to recognize this is Ed's last meeting at the SAG as the FASB's official observer, and just wanted to extend my thanks for his participation and input over the past couple of years. Thanks a lot, Ed.
Just let me say, I've enjoyed it, but I've got to leave here in a few minutes to go meet with 40 bankers who are just agreeing with everything I say.
With that, I'll turn the floor over to Bella Rivshin. Thanks.
Thank you, Tom. Our next topic for the panel discussion will focus on whether more direction should be included in the board's auditing and related professional practice standards about which members of the engagement team are responsible for performing the auditing procedures during an audit engagement. Today's panel discussion will specifically focus on two aspects of the audit, the planning and supervision of the audit engagements, and the areas of the audit that are higher risk or that involve complex issues or an extensive use of professional judgment. The PCAOB interim auditing standards provide direction on how to conduct an audit and perform applicable auditing procedures. The standards, however, do not specifically provide direction as to which members of the engagement team have the responsibility to perform the auditing procedures. In general, the auditing standards provide high-level direction to the audit partner for the planning and supervision of an audit engagement and include a general discussion about technical training and proficiency of the independent auditor. The standards rely on judgment of the audit partner to properly plan and supervise the audit engagement. The auditing standards state that the work performed on an audit engagement is to be adequately planned and supervised, and the engagement team members, if any, are to be properly supervised. The auditing standards also state that the auditor should be assigned to tasks and supervised commensurate with their level of knowledge, skill, and ability so they can evaluate the audit evidence that they are examining. The auditing standards classify the auditors as either the auditor with final responsibility for the audit, typically the audit partner, or assistants, basically everyone else on the engagement team. Although the auditing standards state that the audit partner is responsible for the assignment of tasks and to and the supervision of the engagement team members, in general, the auditing standards do not assign the specific responsibility to the audit partner for the planning and supervision of the audit. The standards also state that the audit partner may delegate portions of the planning and supervision of the audit to other firm personnel without limiting the extent or the portions of the audit planning and supervision that may so be delegated. In contrast, the International Standard on Auditing describes the engagement partner's responsibilities in a bit greater detail. The PCAOB interim auditing standards related to planning the engagement directs the auditor and does not assign the audit partner any specific procedures and responsibilities as to the planning of the audit. With respect to supervision, although the auditing standards require their work to be performed by each engagement team member to be reviewed to determine whether it is adequately performed and to evaluate whether the results are consistent with the conclusions to be presented in the auditor's report, the standard doesn't specify who is required to perform that review. As it relates to performing the audits, the standards in general do not specify which member of the team should perform the auditing procedures relating to the key risk areas of the audit, such as risk assessment, fraud risk analysis, and other aspects of the audit that involve the analysis of complex issues or the extensive use of professional judgment. Rather, the auditing standards in most instances direct the auditor to perform the auditing procedure versus directing the actual audit partner or another member of the engagement team to perform those procedures. In contrast, the PCAOB interim quality control standards provide specific direction to the concurring partner reviewer regarding his or her responsibilities on an audit engagement. The board's interim quality control standards state that the concurring partner fulfills his or her responsibility by, among other things, discussing significant accounting, auditing, and financial reporting matters with the audit engagement partner in reviewing applicable documentation relating to the resolution of the matters, discussing the audit engagement team's identification and the audit of high-risk transactions and account balances, reviewing the summary of unadjusted differences, and reading the financial statements and the auditor's report. Although the quality control standards outline the minimum procedures the recurring partner is responsible for performing, the auditing standards do not have a similar list of specific audit procedures that the audit partner is required to perform on the audit engagements. The PCAOB invited Bill Messier and Mark Peacher to discuss the partner's involvement during the planning and the supervision of the audit engagement and also in the higher risk areas of the audit and areas that involve high complex issues and extensive use of professional judgment. Mr. Messier is a professor of accountancy at Georgia State University, and Mark Peacher is a professor of accountancy at University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Unfortunately, because Mark could not be here today, Bill will also present Mark's prepared remarks on his behalf, which will be followed by an open dialogue among SAG members, observers, panelists, and the PCAOB. With that, I think we're ready to begin, and I will turn it over for Bill for his remarks and Mark's remarks.
Too much high tech here. First of all, Mark and I would like to thank the PCAOB for giving us the opportunity to share our comments with you about this issue. And on a personal level, it's really nice for me to see some of my old friends from my days on the board and other committees, in particular. The question that's on the table is, should auditing standards provide specific guidance as to which members of the audit team should have responsibilities for certain audit procedures? And when Mark and I talked about this, we decided to sort of divvy up the discussion, and I'm sort of going to take more of the standard-setting side, and Mark's comments, which I'll present to you in a minute, talk to some of the research that may shed some light on this issue. And both Mark and I have contributed in this area in terms of the research area. It seems to me when you look at this, who should do what on the audit, you can look at this at two levels. One level is what I call the high level, which goes beyond just the two topics that are on the agenda today, and that's the question of just how prescriptive should auditing standards be. And this is not the first time I've had to address this. Tom was the one who got me appointed to the International Auditing Standards Subcommittee, I think, when it was formed in 1998, and I think I ended up chairing it from 2003 to 2005. And one of the, seemed like always one of the discussions at those meetings was, are the U.S. standards more prescriptive than the ISAs? I see John down there. I found ISA 220 to be interesting because I found that to be more prescriptive than the U.S. standards. But this is a big issue. And just how much guidance do we need to have there? And the second level would be sort of where we are today, and that is how much prescription should there be at the engagement team level? It seems to me as standard setters, there's three choices. One is to be very prescriptive, and that's provide very detailed guidance. The second choice, of course, is to be principle-based. And I guess there you would allow, you just have some very general principles in the standards and allow the firms to provide detailed guidance within their own firm methodologies. And I think the third position is some mix of the two. I think I know where I stand on that, but it's not my position to pick a side. With respect to today's two areas, and I guess the comments later on will follow those along. One, planning and supervision and performing the audit. Bella mentioned a minute ago that there is more detailed guidance on concurring partner in the standards, the interim standards. I've actually done some research in this area. Tom is familiar with this. I compared the guidance across the Big Four plus two of the other three firms, and not surprisingly, the guidance is pretty similar. What I'd like to do now is shift over to Mark's comments, and I'll probably interject some of my own as I read through his comments. But I think Mark has done a really nice job of providing what I think are some interesting insights, into this issue. And I'm going to read these so I don't misquote him, although I have taken the liberty of editing out a couple of sentences in this for brevity. As a former editor, I don't feel bad doing that. I deeply appreciate the opportunity to try and enhance the PCAOB-SEG's discussion regarding engagement team performance. Before expressing my views, I will note that although a number of colleagues have helped to shape my views, the views expressed here are entirely my own. In addition, if persons would like to know what conceptual model of financial statement auditing informs my view, I would refer them to the recent monograph, The 21st Century Public Company Audit, that I co-authored, meaning Mark, with Tim Bell of KPMG and Ira Solomon of Illinois. Now, on to my comments. First, despite the new prescriptive language regarding auditor rank that appears in ISA 220, my view, and I believe the prior consensus view among auditing professionals and market participants, was that that engagement partners have the ultimate responsibility for all the major audit tasks. So what's the news? There's little or no news, so I presume the purpose of the standard was other than to provide news. Perhaps it is to alter documentation requirements or to provide a better archive of conventional thinking. Second, once one starts moving away from principle-based standards and towards prescribing what auditors should perform, which auditors should perform an audit procedure, or which auditors should be prohibited from doing so, two things easily could happen. One, who performs or what comprises an audit becomes a bit more predictable. This potentially jeopardizes audit effectiveness. Second, individuals will change how they interpret standards. Observe the different phrases that the new ISA 220 uses to describe engagement partner responsibilities. I'm uncertain whether there are intended qualitative differences in the degree of responsibility or different involvement required by the engagement partner across these variations. And let me quote these to you. There's a number of sentences that say the engagement partner should, and then it goes on, take responsibility for, consider whether, form a conclusion, be satisfied that, and be responsible for. I'm not quite sure where that takes us. Third, that's my comment, by the way. Shifting gears a bit, one yardstick that I would encourage members of the SAG and the board to consider is whether and the extent to which contemplated prescriptions could have unintended consequences of substantially limiting the ability of an engagement team or engagement partner to undertake alternative compensatory approaches to ensuring high-quality planning and execution of audit procedures. Although there's not a perfect analogy, attending surgeons can engage in considerably more instruction and real-time monitoring when a green resident performs a surgical procedure than when a more experienced resident does so. Fourth, I want to emphasize that financial statement auditing to me largely is a professional judgment and decision-making journey rather than a prescribed set of cookbook procedures that are to be performed by specific members of an engagement team. I'm going to interject. I agree with that. As such, when identifying ways to ensure high-quality engagement team performance, I believe auditors should be advised to dutifully consider the set of risk factors that both cumulative wisdom from audit practice and theory consistent findings in the scholarly auditing literature suggest would impair professional judgment. To this end, I would encourage the SAG and the board members to explicitly consider auditors' requirements to be professionally skeptical. Engagement teams and engagement partners not only should be professionally skeptical of audit team management and audit evidence, but also of their own professional judgments, which happen to be fallible. I agree with that, too. That is, much like auditors must build a fudge factor for sampling risk when conducting sampling, they should circumspectively consider whether additional or different kinds of evidence is necessary in the light of professional judgment risk. I believe doing so would enhance quality control over specific financial statement auditing engagements. There is no empirical study that I can point to back up my belief, but 2 decades of auditing research has certainly identified a lot of shortcomings in auditor judgment. One consequence of this view is that rank-based and other prescriptions are not good substitutes for and may detract from the perceived need for the engagement partner, along with other members of the engagement team, an audit firm, to be skeptical of the quality of the engagement partners and other judgments in reaching key conclusions. Similarly, all engagement team members should ask hard questions about their own and other engagement members' capabilities, which may be lower than you might think. And this issue was raised in some of the prior discussions, and maybe we can come back to it later. With respect to this issue, the auditing literature has two messages. One is that auditors tend to be overly optimistic about their own and others' knowledge and or propensity to reach judgment errors. This holds for supervising auditors assessing subordinates with whom they frequently work. Among the existing studies on this topic is a paper that Mark co-authored with Jane Kennedy. He makes reference to a new paper that I've just finished that has a similar lesson. The basic point of those papers is that partners, managers, and seniors are overly optimistic of either the knowledge or the abilities of their subordinates. Now, that may not surprise you, but it's certainly empirical evidence. A second message is that for a couple of decades now, the auditing literature has noted that auditor rank is a noisy and imperfect measure and may provide a poor yardstick for assessing the extent to which auditor is likely to have sufficient knowledge and skills to plan and execute an audit procedure. The auditing literature underscores the advantages of using a family of cues to help assess auditor's capability and not just rank. One salient cue is the extent to which the auditor has industry-specific experience or specialization. And again, we've seen a number of research studies in the last 4 or 5 years that clearly indicate industry specialization is probably the key factor. I'll end with what I believe is the key variation of this idea. Prospective engagement partners often substantially differ in terms of their capabilities to be suitable engagement partners for a specific audit. ISA 220, it seems to me, is silent on this kind of variation in interpartner capabilities. Yet my understanding is that audit firm quality control teams help govern and at least sometimes effectively assign partners to specific engagements. I would recommend that any contemplated standard on engagement team performance avoid remaining silent on this issue. Those are my brief comments on today's topic. Thanks for the opportunity to try and contribute to your thinking. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill and Mark, for those comments. At this point, we are going to turn to our first topic of discussion, which deals with planning and supervision. We have two topics that we'd like to cover for the next about 30 minutes. One is, what is the level of involvement that the audit partner should have in the planning and supervision of the audit engagement? And two, should the auditing standards specify the audit partner's role in the planning of the audit, the staffing of the engagement, determining the proper level of supervision of less experienced engagement team members, or other aspects of the planning and supervision of the audit engagement? And now I will open up to the floor. Joe Carcello?
A couple of issues. The first issue, Bella, is does the board have any evidence that the standard's broken? You know, I think that's always a useful place to start. And is there any evidence from inspections that audit tasks are routinely being performed by the wrong person? It would seem to me if you have that evidence, then it's more compelling that this issue needs to be revisited. Without that evidence, I'm not exactly sure why you'd want to revisit the issue. The other thing I would throw out for consideration is my read of AS number 5 is that it provides greater discretion to auditors in using the work of others, regardless of the title of the person doing the work. Specifying required audit steps for audit partners and others seems to be moving in the opposite direction. And so it would seem to me that there's a fundamental inconsistency there that's probably worth thinking about.
John Morrissey?
Yeah, I guess I'll sort of anecdotally answer your first question, which was, is there any evidence to suggest that the wrong people are being assigned to tasks? In the prepare mode, you tend to see a lot of very junior auditors asking sometimes very difficult questions on very difficult areas. And you're always a little frustrated by their lack of experience, but that's sort of the nature of the game, and you go through the process and you work with them and educate them, because you know at some point that junior's person's work papers are going to be reviewed by a manager, and if it's a particularly sensitive area and they've done a good job of reviewing and documenting the discussion, it'll provide a good sound basis for the engagement partner to draw a conclusion as to whether or not what you've done is right. So, on the one hand, it's a yeah. There, you'd always like to see a more senior person doing the work, but the reality is, people got to get trained, they got to get educated, and you just kind of keep your fingers crossed that person comes back next year and is working on your engagement, and we already have a step ahead in terms of learning curve. But on the second notion here, do you really want to get in the business of dictating to the accounting firms exactly who's going to do what? If I put my auditor hat on, which I wore for many years, no two audit engagements are really staffed the same. Different partners have different skill sets, different managers have different skill sets, different staff people have different skill sets, and you need to be able to make reasoned adjustments to your staffing and assignment of tasks, and you need some flexibility. It's part of the fun of the profession is to be able to exercise professional judgment. And while the thought of, gee, let's have a nice framework for assignment of tasks and responsibilities, I would really be hesitant to start to micromanage how firms' staff engagements assign tasks to individual areas. I don't know if they really want to be in that business. I think having a good articulated framework for what the objectives are of a review, what the objectives are of an engagement partner or a manager in a particular area would be helpful. But to say that one individual's got to do this particular area or that particular area, I just think isn't very helpful at all.
Bob Kippers?
Val, I agree with Joe's comments and John's comments. I think the answer, though, to what you've got up on the screen there is what should the level of involvement be? I think it's whatever is sufficient in order that the partner maintain that overall responsibility for the outcome of the engagement. I think if you get any deeper than that, it's a slippery slope. When you were teeing this up, you mentioned the kind of the laundry list of things that are required for the concurring reviewer to look at. Unadjusted errors, all the key documents, the financial statements, the footnotes. Now, the audit standards don't actually say that the audit partner has to be comfortable with everything on that list before it goes to the concur. But I think it's pretty fundamental that would be the case. You can't concur in something that hasn't been first reviewed. And you think the partner has that as principal responsibility. Do we need the standard to say that? I don't know. If it's important, sure. But I think it's sort of intrinsic in the whole model. And I would not recommend specifying, particularly as you get from, think of the small engagement, partner, manager, senior accountant, one or two staff people. They probably all sit in the same room. And, to have specific requirements on that end of the market, and then you take the other end where we have engagements where there are over 100 partners involved in one audit. Now, if the partner can't do a certain amount of delegation, he's actually going to miss some of the more important issues that he or she's responsible for. So I think flexibility is the key.
Jeff Steinhoff?
I just want to echo what the first three have said here. I think they really got to the nexus of the issue. You have to lay out what the objective is and what the audit organization, whether it be one partner, 100 partners, what the audit organization is responsible for achieving, and how they go about achieving that is going to differ from engagement to engagement. And I think they have to ensure themselves that they've got competent people to carry out the various tasks that would be expected to do a professional job on a given audit. So I just want to agree with what was said before me.
Marty Hanisch?
I guess to
go back to the question that was raised maybe by Joe. I mean, is there a problem that needs to be fixed here? Is there evidence to suggest that there is inappropriate supervision, of the planning of an audit engagement? I mean, are you at liberty to discuss that?
We were actually looking for the SAG members to give us their input on that.
Well, I guess my perspective is based upon my experience with our audit team at Lilly is that I feel there's appropriate levels of engagement by the audit partner when that audit partner needs to be engaged. I think there's appropriate delegation to senior managers to plan the audit. But I have seen certainly a dynamic that has occurred, with respect to the integration of the substantive testing and internal control activity, with the advent of AS2 and AS5, that the audit partner certainly, and through the dynamics and the discussions that take place with us, at times gets, certainly more involved and has, shall we say, trumped the senior manager on certain aspects of the audit, which I think is appropriate, at least from the preparer's perspective, in an appropriate way. But I don't see, at least with respect to our engagement, where anything's broken, where I would suggest anything's broken.
Ted White?
I had exactly the same question as Joe, actually, which when I first read this was, in fact, right in the margin here says, is it broken? That's obviously a good question. I'm interested in the perspective of both the issuers as well as the practitioners. And then sort of a secondary observation is it appears to be fairly obvious that our approach to this is much more principle-based. And the sort of choice here is to move to a more rules-based approach to the international, which is kind of polar opposite to all of our broader discussions and other issues. And the other thing that occurred to me is that if this is broken, that does not really bode well for the much more complicated issues we're expecting a principle-based standards to address. To me, maybe I'm missing something, but this seems to me to be very common sense, straightforward, and if they can't use judgment to put the right people with the right set of experiences on the auditing tasks, then the far more complicated things that the principle-based approach is supposed to address are going to fail. So, it's a great question that Joe had, and I'm really interested in the bottom of that answer. Is if it's really broken, we've got big, big problems.
Ernie Baum? Can you turn on your mic?
Thank you. I'm not so sure that the standards we have are broken. I think what's missing is the required competencies for an individual to be an engagement partner. I think this was touched on in the comments, but I have seen instances where tax-only partners were designated as engagement partners, know very little about auditing the judgments that's required, and that's something that I think is just not acceptable, and it happens constantly.
Bob Tirola?
Thank you, Bill. It seems to me that this question runs to the business model of the auditing profession. And as it shifts to a more risk-based approach, from the prescriptive approach, it is going to require more judgment and generally judgment by more experienced people. As a consumer of auditing services, I don't think it's broken in the context that the job doesn't get done or doesn't get done well. But I do think that in order for the job to get done well in an AS5 world, there's much more experience needed to be brought to the engagement, with the trade-off, I hope, in cost being fewer inexperienced people. But that creates a major dilemma, I think. To the pyramid type business model that the firms mostly have, and would it need to narrow that pyramid in order to have specialists and other experts, more experienced people, involved with the work, given the judgments involved under the newer model?
Kaylin Hansen.
To
the question, is it broken? I don't think it's broken. If we wanted to give some guidance, I think that's one thing. But hopefully it would be flexible, principles-based, has been brought out. Scalability, certainly, the engagements that I'm on as opposed to what Bob has in his firm and the national firms are just different animals. The scaling is so different, but it's even so within my firm. I'm not sure that managers and seniors, we need to delineate what their responsibilities are versus partners. And I think Ernie brought up the question, just the general competency of partners and what that should be. I personally can't imagine that a tax partner would be signed as an audit engagement partner. I can't conceive of that type of situation. If that's happening, hopefully the inspectors are picking up on that. But there might be more pressure with the rotation requirements in some of the smaller firms to be putting individuals in those situations. I would imagine probably more in the concurring partner role than there would be in the engagement partner role. And then the other thing that I did want to mention is the concurring partner or the engagement quality review that we've been talking about. I really believe those standards need to be updated and gotten out. I do notice that the concurring partner review is really coming from the standpoint of a sort of negative assurance, if you will. Ultimately, the audit partner has to be responsible for everything, and they're signing that report. I believe that that's probably enough for me personally. That's enough guidance.
Harold Monk.
I would agree with what everyone has said so far, but I think we also have to be concerned that we not put something that might be counterproductive in the standards from the perspective that as we move into the risk, more of the risk-based approach, that it could influence the level of risk that is actually assessed in key areas and for relevant assertions for significant accounts. And based on who might be available on the team, push that risk assessment below where it otherwise might be so that more individuals on the team would be qualified to perform the procedures that are being anticipated. I don't know that anyone would intentionally do that, but I think there would be an influence inevitably in the planning process to consider those things.
Randy Fletchall.
Well, just a couple of observations. First of all, I don't think it's broken. In fact, I would say over the last 5 or 6 years, I think partner time and executive involvement in the audit has probably increased. I think, as Bill mentioned, we do all have our own guidance that we've built in for our engagements that give our partners direction as to where to spend the time, and I think it's to spend it in appropriate areas and particularly in the riskier areas. So I think we can have that part of it where it should be. Second, the one thing that does seem unusual, and I guess just to put it in context, is the fact that there's more specificity on what a concurring partner does than a lead partner. And just to remind everybody, that really stems out of the profession in another era, in self-regulation, deciding to add on its own an independent review partner, concurring partner role, and in doing so kind of spelled out what they thought was necessary. And so it does go beyond what was otherwise in the auditing standards for a lead partner. That's been carried forward into the board's interim rules, so it probably makes sense for those to get balanced somehow. It doesn't make a lot of sense to remain with much, much more specificity for an independent review partner, concurring partner, and a lead partner, but I don't think that means you need a whole lot of specificity to add on to what a lead partner needs to do. I think keep the principles, keep the judgment, and we'll be fine.
John Kellett.
Thank you. I first of all say that I agree with most, if not everything, that has already been said, and particularly Harold's point about risk-based approaches and the need to get appropriate judgment at the appropriate stages. And I agree with the comments about don't change standards if they're not broken. I think that is extremely important because as standard setters, we can sit around sometimes and think, well, what should we do next? We've got a bit of time. Let's do something more. And I think that can be can be extremely harmful, and I can wax at considerable length about the UK government's approach along those lines, but I shan't. I think that 2 points I want to make about our standards. One is that I don't think you should be left with the impression that they are terribly specific about what the audit partner needs to do. And the list of language that Bill read out at the beginning was, you'll note, was take responsibility for, form a conclusion about, be satisfied that. They were directing the engagement partner to those areas which specifically required the engagement partner's attention, and I don't think that's a bad thing. Secondly, in our case, when we revised the standard, our standards were broken in the sense that our quality control standard was a bit old-fashioned and also failed to distinguish between quality control at the level of the firm and quality control at the level of the engagement. So we had a specific job to do to split that out. And I think what we... second thing is that standards are a product of their time. And one of the things that we specifically wished to do was to make sure that appropriate people were looking at appropriate issues, both within an engagement and at the firm level. And, for example, when one looks at the quality control standard for a firm, a lot of emphasis is put on the fact that quality must be something that is the responsibility of someone who is sufficiently senior. And, in fact, quality within the firm, that is, it really rests at chief executive, managing partner level, or his or her delegatee, but at the appropriate level within the firm. So that sort of concept was introduced. And other matters such as the assessment of engagement partners for audit ought to put quality above business development, for example. Now, how you demonstrate these matters is perhaps difficult, but I think a few years ago you would probably all agree that sort of message was an important message which had to be got through the profession. So I think there's more to the standards than the simple question of responsibilities of the engagement part. And I think in revising our standard, the relevant responsibilities within firms were something that was extremely important at the time the standard was written.
Lynn Turner.
Some observations. First, as an audit committee chair, I do get the hour breakdown on the audits where I chair the audit committees by staffing level. And the partner hours are a higher percentage now than what I was accustomed to a half dozen years or so ago, although they're not significantly higher. So it's moving in the right direction. Probably still not enough movement in that direction, though probably could still go a fair amount more. And I've had a number of occasions where I've turned around and asked the audit partner about particular things on different audits and risk areas, and the audit partner will real quickly say, hey, why don't I have the audit manager answer that for you? And it doesn't take a rocket scientist or to figure out why that question is directed to the audit manager, and it has certainly caught my attention and given me the ability to then go back and grill the audit partner. Usually, the next time back, the audit partner knows the answer. But I'm still not sure we're getting the hours out of the top person, and considering you've just done an AS5. That says, in essence, the key to any successful audit there is to be able to do a top-down risk assessment. We've got a proven track record of not doing real well on that in this industry. If you don't adjust the current standard to make sure that those hours at the hours that go into making that assessment, if they don't come from that partner more so than what they have in the past, you aren't going to get a top-down risk-based audit. You just aren't going to do it. And that shows up in some of the reports that we've seen over the last year, especially over the last in 2007 at Glass Lewis, we have been able to pick up a number of filings where we just look through the filing and find that the accounting has been done wrong. Call up the company. The company's traditional answer is, I've cleared it with my partner, and my partner guarantees me it's absolutely right. And we put out a report, and within a short period of time, weeks, if not a month or two, there's a restatement coming through on that issue. And I think this goes back to Ernie's question of it's not only about the staff down below the partner, but it's the partner. Are we getting the right people on these audits? And when someone out in Broomfield, Colorado can pick up a public filing, not once, not twice, but a number of times, and find errors in it just by reading the filing, it tells you that there's still something not right about that, either competency-wise or training-wise, because it's not one. It's the senior missed it, the manager missed it, and at least two partners missed it. And when I look at the inspection reports, we have seen inspection reports time after time come out of this body that cite some pretty significant misses that you wonder how someone could miss those if everyone was on top of it. And back to Joe's point, I go back and go through those inspection reports and say, what was missing? What happened that went wrong? Is it a performance issue? If it's a performance issue, then I'm severely disappointed in the PCLB inspection or enforcement process, because we ain't seen no enforcement. And it's just non-existent, especially among the big top six firms. It just, cases haven't been there. If it's not performance, then it's got to be in the standard. And you ought to be able to come back and tell us then, based upon what you've seen in your inspections, what's wrong with the standard. And it's not just the standard, perhaps more important, is what's in the firm's own guidance manuals themselves, because usually the firm's own guidance manuals in this area are much better than any standard that the standard setters have ever written. And they're just really good. And so I say if there's a problem, the part of the process has to be, what is it that you would change in the firm's own manuals? And I'd actually start there before I'd start with the auditing standard, because I think those manuals are just, for the most part, the ones that I've seen are just exceptionally good. And why don't you have performance with those manuals? And that comes out of the inspection process. But your inspections, and part of this is quality control, so we don't see it. We aren't supposed to see it unless it's not a corrected problem. We haven't seen anything in enforcement or anything, so I assume any problems have been corrected. So there's kind of a bit of a disconnect between what we're seeing in the inspection reports and then people saying there's not a problem.
Howard Johnson.
Well, I think it's good to bring these things up proactively. My own opinion, I don't think this area is broken, but it's good to bring it up and surface it. And Lynn said what I was going to say a lot. The other thing that's happened is the audit committees are, my observations, increasingly looking at the caliber of the audit team, the entirety of it. Obviously, they're very involved in selecting who the new engagement partner will be, but also the entire team and the level of detail that's required these days. My observations as to who's going to be on the team when they present the plan and the type of comments that are directed to the individual members of the audit team is to test their knowledge, see how much they really know what's going on within that company they're auditing, has really increased in the last several years. So you have to take that type of thing, which, there's been more requirements of the audit committee being more actively managing the public accounting firm. You have to take that into account here, too.
Ben Coleman.
I guess just to briefly, I'm supportive of the vast majority of what was said here with respect to, you know, is there really a problem? But I just really do caution against trying to be very prescriptive at who does what, giving, I guess, the scalability point that was made there all the way to, you know, we've got the engagements as Bob said, you know, where we've got many, many partners on the engagements and very complex teams and, you know, specialty people and special skill sets. And I'd encourage you to think more in terms of skill set than title. And I'd also encourage you, instead of very similar to, I think, what John was saying, you know, for some reason we seem to be going to this standard versus the quality more appropriately should be determined in the quality control standards. So I'm just wondering why this conversation's here, because it's more appropriate in the quality control standards.
Jeff Steinhoff.
I think Joe, when he began this session, and Lynn summed it up well, you do have a very important tool in the fact that you've got all these inspections. And I think really making a determination, is this a standards issue or an execution issue or a competency issue? And the audit firm is responsible for doing a quality job. And if your finding is part of the inspection process or finding by a prevalence of restatements or other problems that they are not doing a quality job, then you have to get behind that and determine why. And there could be a variety of reasons for it. But what I'm hearing today, and it kind of sets forth with my own belief, is that I think people aren't seeing it so much as the standard, but it's how one carries out the standard. So if you can really focus in on those inspections and where are the areas where it's not being done properly, and is there a need for guidance in certain areas? And maybe guidance is really the way to go in some of this.
Bob Kippers.
I guess just quickly, but listening to the last few comments, and Lynn in his own way has raised a very interesting point. Ben mentioned quality control standards. Maybe that's where this kind of thing should reside. But I think what it comes down to is, at the end of the day, when there's a problem and there is an enforcement matter, an action, performance issues historically, in at least our experience with the SEC enforcement regime, you know, individual performance meant a case against the person, whether it's the partner or somebody at another level. If the firm itself had something more systemic that was wrong, then the firm would be at risk for enforcement action. And as I listen to all of this, quality control standards mean that the procedures, the manuals, the training, you know, that's the responsibility of the firm as an organization. Performance issues by people not following that guidance and not stepping up to their responsibilities as prescribed, that's a little different issue. So to me, this is just fascinating because in the PCOB realm, we don't really know what the rules are yet. We don't have a body of history here. But I think it requires the board and the staff to give a lot of consideration as to whether guidance in this area should reside in the QC standards or in the audit standards, because I think you have a different outcome when you hold people accountable at the end of the day.
Jeff Sahel.
I wanted to comment on something Bob just said, that I might be taking this out of context. I guess I believe that the responsibility for not following a given firm policy, organization policy, rests not just with the partner or team that hasn't followed it, but it ultimately rests with the organization. So I would ratchet everything up and say the organization, the firm, is responsible for making sure that they have partners, managers all the way down the line in place that understand the firm policies and procedures, that follow them, and that raise any issues as they come due with a policy or process or procedure they cannot follow. So I think in an ultimate sense, one must place the onus on the audit firm to ensure that their partners are properly trained all the way down the line. and they're following all the practices, policies, and procedures. Now, the PCOB comes in and does its inspection as, I view it as a secondary inspection. But the firm has the ultimate responsibility, and if one finds that these practices or policies, the partner didn't do a good job, or the manager's all the way down, I would say the organization should be the one responsible, in addition to the partner. I'm not sure that's what I got policy the partner, but maybe I'm wrong.
Sorry, just a follow-up. I'm already regretting I even raised this issue. But you know, I do agree with you, but I think the truth is that if there's a problem on an individual audit, it's very fact-dependent. I mean, you could have a great system. You have a great culture. You could have great tone, good reinforcement, good internal and external inspections, and still have a situation where somebody, you know, flies off the reservation, and I don't think it's automatic that the firm should be subjected to an enforcement action. I think that should be fact-dependent. But as a philosophy, I agree that the leadership of the firm, you know, owns the need for quality and has to instill that throughout the ranks. I don't doubt that at all.
Bill Messier?
I wasn't sure you were going to let me talk, Tom. I said I didn't have an I wasn't going to state my opinion. I think there are probably points in the standard-setting process where you may want to be specific. And I think the one that makes sense to me is the one that's already there, the notion that the partner ought to participate in brainstorming. I mean, I think if you think about that, I mean, I suspect most firms have that in their standards, but I could think of examples where the partner just says, all right, you guys go ahead and have this meeting and tell me what happened later on. And in that case, all of that cumulative knowledge that partner has about that engagement might be lost. So I think I'm generally rule-based, but I can think of a couple of exceptions to where I would put this information into the standards. That's my 2 cents.
This is actually a good topic to move on to some of our other discussion questions. The people who had the 10 cards up, feel free to leave them up. As we're going to the performing the audit, we had a couple other topics that we wanted to put on the table. The first one is whether the auditing standards should direct the senior member or the members of the engagement team to be directly involved in the higher risk areas of the audit, such as risk assessment, fraud risk analysis, and other aspects of the audit that involve analysis of complex issues or the extensive use of professional judgment. And then also whether the auditing standards should define or outline specific roles for the auditors at each level of the engagement team. And finally, on a topic that's already had a few comments, whether special consideration should be given to audit engagements that are based on the size and complexity of the issuer being audited or the size of the accounting firm. Joe Carcello?
Well, I'll make a comment about this, and then I'll address my other comment. I think these questions are similar to what we've been talking about already. So to specify that the audit partner has to do some of these tasks and to provide no flexibility for specific circumstances, I think would probably be a mistake. It's hard to disagree that the audit partner should be involved in considering fraud risk. I think that's pretty obvious. But imagine a situation where the audit partner had responsibility for assessing fraud risk, but if a senior manager on the engagement was a CPA, CFE, and had prior experience with the FBI, wouldn't he or she be a better fit to take the lead role? At the end of the day, the partner is responsible. But in that particular case, the senior manager may just have better expertise, and it may make sense for him or her to take the lead role there. The second point that I make, which is not really teed up in any of your questions, but I'm just curious if you've even batted around a discussion of this. We're talking about engagement team performance, and Lynn correctly points out situations where he's sitting in Broomfield, Colorado, and recognizes problems with published financial statements, and then you kind of question, how does that happen? So at the end of the day, I think the real concern here is how do you make engagement teams perform better? And one thing that I know has happened in some foreign countries, I'm far from an expert on this, so others may know more, but in some foreign countries, the partner has to sign his or her name alongside the firm's signature. And if you look at the behavioral literature, there's some evidence to suggest that that additional level of personable accountability, public accountability, has an effect. And so what would be interesting to look at, and again, I don't know if you guys have the capabilities to do this, but again, you always have the ability to commission research. Is there any evidence that when foreign jurisdictions change the regime from a situation where the partner didn't sign his or her name to did, to where they did, is there any evidence that audit quality improved? And if there's evidence that audit quality improved, then it's probably worth thinking about here in the U.S. If there's no evidence that audit quality improved, then you probably let the idea drop.
Lynn Turner.
On the second question about based on size and all, I think the answer is yes. I think there is a big difference between auditing a General Electric and the skill sets that it takes amongst the engagement team to audit that type of multinational, broad-based company versus someone that's auditing a $50 million, $20 million a year company. It's just different. And the skill sets and the coordination and the administration and the ability to keep it together on those two are different. Sometimes it's a small company that's harder, and sometimes it's a large company. But I actually don't think engagement teams move back and forth in between those two environments all that well. I think we saw some of that in the first year of the internal control testing. People weren't able to move up and down in company size and tailor it the way it should be. So I think this needs to be dealt with. Maybe the best place to deal with it is in the firm's own manuals themselves. But I think there has to be recognition if you got two different skill sets when you're managing the audits of those two different size companies. They just aren't the same, and the issues and the complexities dramatically. I would certainly agree with or tee up the issue Joe has. I personally think that it does make a difference from behavioral aspect, and that's really what we're talking about here, because we're talking about performance, if a partner had to put their own name on the report or not. And I think if any partner had a qualm about putting their own name on a report, they ought to be thinking about whether they're willing to sign with the firm's name. And I'd certainly encourage you to think that about that. And I'm a firm believer the firm partner ought to be willing and should put their name on a report to investors.
Wes Williams.
I agree with the statement Lynn made, but I have a little different take on it. But I think the audit standards need to be scalable based on the size and complexity of the entity, but not based so much on the size of the audit firm itself. I want to pick up on a theme that's kind of come through here. We have to look at the competency of the audit teams and the competencies of the firm itself. And I think these are already accepted by the board, the quality control standards they've adopted, which address both the firm competencies as well as the partner charge competencies. So it kind of goes back to this whole theme of getting the right person on the right job.
Bob Pertola.
Just on the point that Joe and Lynn were making about the psychological difference between signing one's personal name and signing a firm's name, I used to sign audit opinions in the name of a firm, and now I'm certifying financial statements under SOX in my personal name. And I would like to believe it wouldn't make a difference, but it does. It's psychologically different.
I'm in an organization where we sign our own name. And if I'm signing my own name, I check everything over 100 times. And if I'm sending it up for the Comptroller General to sign his name, I check it over 200 times. I think it does make a difference. Although, I don't think for any one moment that signing a firm name means that the partners that are doing that aren't trying to do a very good job, because the firm name is very important to them. So I'm not sure at what level it makes a difference. And I think they still bring that professional pride, and they still feel they're responsible and accountable for it.
Mick Coleman?
Yeah, I didn't want to let that go without. I mean, I appreciate those final comments because it may affect behavior. I don't know. I haven't done a study, and I have no idea. And I understand there's some common practices in Europe and whatever. But I can assure you, I mean, I've been signing opinions for 25 years. And when you're signing that opinion, all right, part of it's your firm. But part of it is, if there's an issue, I mean, everyone knows who signs that opinion. Look at any enforcement release. Look at, you know, when there is an issue, okay, even a PCAOB review, it's very clear who is responsible for the work that is performed, ultimately responsible for the work performed on that engagement. And so to say that, you know, writing it will have a significant change in an engagement partner's behavior, I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, it may, but I would tell you, I think you'd be not fully understanding, I think, particularly in the last 5 years. I mean, as Randy said, there's been a significant change in the last 5 years with respect to the accountability, with respect to what the engagement partners, you know, feel and do. And I just don't want that to be go unsaid.
Jeff Rochello?
Yeah, I agree with Vince, and I don't want anyone to misinterpret. I think the overwhelming majority of partners take their responsibility of signing the firm's name very, very seriously. All I was suggesting is that it might be worth thinking about, and to the extent that there is data available on foreign countries, it might be worth considering. But I'm not suggesting for a moment that most partners are signing the firm's name without being very comfortable that they're doing the right thing.
Any other comments? I know, Randy, you had your tent card up at one point and put it back down.
Only because Bob Kipper has raised the issue of quality control, which he regrets, I have to comment also. I think in this whole era, when we talk about what an audit partner or the lead partner is responsible for, you do have to have that in a large firm, there are quality control systems in place, and that partner should be able to rely on those, or else we will have very inefficient systems. So when it comes to in a large firm and coordinating a large audit around the world, you can't expect that lead partner to have been responsible for training of everyone who's on that team, which you could do if you were in a very small firm doing a handful of audits. So I just sometimes, no one is saying the lead partner is not, in a sense, very responsible for that audit opinion that he signs either internally or, you know, on an opinion that would have the firm's name also. But you really do have to allow that partner to rely on firm's quality control system around many things like independence, like training, like competency, or you just couldn't have each person do it. So I would just keep that in mind as you start looking at the one-hand prescription. That's a concern I have for actually, John, when you read ISA, you can read that and say, this sounds like the partner's supposed to do all this, and sometimes the firm does it. And to your point, Jeff, at the end of the day, both the firm and the partner are going to be held responsible if there's a problem. So you might as well.
Any other comments? Oh, Savannah?
So we're beating this issue to death. I'll just add in one more thought. And that's from the perspective of the users and, in particular, investors in the marketplace. And one of the aspects of that I had always thought with the firm name being on the opinion was that's what it meant from a user perspective. The investors cared that it was the firm. So another model has to actually ask what's the usefulness of that information to the marketplace also.
Lynn Turner?
I'd turn around and challenge you on that, Silvana. We turned around and
it,
we
it
said
it wouldn't be the first time Lynn has challenged me on something.
And I can guarantee it probably won't be the last either.
So can I.
We sit here and we tell public companies it makes a difference to them. They used to sign with the general sign-off page on a 10-K and on the Qs, and now we've got them doing this very specific certification, and all the firms sitting around the table here supported those CEOs and CFO having to certify to the accuracy of the financial statements. I find it somewhat astounding that firms would say for public companies and for a CEO and CFO, they absolutely got to do this because we need their butt on the line and it does make a difference to them. But for us as audit partners, oh, it really doesn't make a difference. We'll do it. That's just unfathomable. You think people act two different ways like that. And I think absolutely if we're going to force the CEO and CFO to put their name on the line, then we ought to be turning around and putting the auto partner's name on the line. And if they got a problem with doing that, then I, as an investor, I do want to know that because that does give me informational content.
Savannah? Well, I think the question is not whether your name is on the line or not. It's what it means and the mechanism by which it occurs. So it's different. It's important to recognize these are two different settings and what a signature means and what it signals. And as all I'm suggesting, Lynn, is it's probably important to think about the signaling aspect of this, not just laying your signature on the line per se. Damon Silvers?
Well, I found this last exchange very informative because I was sitting there listening, trying to figure out what is this debate about? Now I know. Because it seemed to me that the sort of issues that were teed up here were ones that it'd be very difficult. If people aren't doing their jobs, they don't understand what they are and so forth, how are you going to write a standard that's going to fix that? And is it really true that they don't understand what their jobs are? And I'm just completely baffled by it. But now I understand what it's about. It's about whether or not you sign the person's name and the firm's name, or just the person's name or just the firm's name. And it strikes me that really this can't possibly be something people are seriously arguing about. It is useful from the perspective of investors, and not just from a punitive kind of approach, but from an informative approach to have both. And the signaling is that A, there is a firm here, and that the person who is signing it with the full backing and support of and which investor can rely upon with the firm and its own procedures and philosophies, and that there is a natural human being that one could, if one wanted to, talk to about what this means. That strikes me as sort of plain and simple, and shouldn't be that terribly controversial. But again, I thought I was missing something for a while. Maybe I'm still missing something.
Sir Carcello?
There's another potential benefit of having the partner sign that just occurred to me. There's a pretty extensive literature in academia on expertise. So it was alluded to this morning by Bill Messier. And the earlier work on expertise basically found that firms that do more work in a particular industry do higher quality audits. But as everyone knows, audits are done by audit teams, even though the firm signs it. And some more recent work, done primarily by Jerry Francis and some of his colleagues, looks at the quality at the local office level and finds that there's higher quality if the local office has more industry expertise in whatever the industry is of the particular client. The really interesting question would be, is the quality higher, and as we would presume it would be, if the engagement team, primarily the partner, had more industry expertise. If partners had to sign, it wouldn't take very long, and it'd be a database of every public company, at least, that they serve. And you could start measuring expertise at the individual partner level in industries, and then you could track whether or not that translated into higher audit quality.
Again, like Damon, maybe I'm starting to understand this issue, and maybe I'm not. But I want to reflect back to a point that Bob Kippers made. So I'm glad he's here because I want to make sure that I'm understanding. And I don't mean to be critical of it, of his point, but I think he raised the point, which I think is very important, about the idea that once in a while it's possible that an audit partner can get off the reservation with respect to his or her firm. And if so, what's the responsibility of the firm? How do we build mechanisms to minimize the likelihood that that could happen? Right. So, apropos our discussion about how many people we're going to have sign this report, one possibility would be to think about the idea that the partner is signing the report on his or her behalf, as well as the firm's, but that the concurring partner also could sign, representing that the firm's quality controls are in place and that the concurring partner is really signing on behalf of the firm, almost against the partner. That's a very provocative idea, so it probably isn't worth much, but we have 6 minutes, and I thought I'd say something.
Sam Rinsella.
I have no idea what we're talking about now. I can't speak for all of my audit partners. I surely can't speak for any that aren't in my firm. But I can speak for myself, and I can tell you unequivocally that when I signed KPMG, and if I signed my name below it, it would make no difference. It would not change my behavior in one iota if my name went underneath KPMG, and I believe that most of my partners feel the same way. The answer, Dick's interesting. I was trying to give some context around the quality control system. I think it's important to keep in mind that any quality control system has a cost-benefit relationship, just like a company's internal control system cannot, from a cost-benefit perspective, ever support absolute assurance around the quality of the information. And the same is true with our system. So we have built, again, I can only speak for my firm, we believe we've built a quality control system that provides reasonable assurance about the quality of our audits. Does that mean we are going to be 100% accurate, that we will never have some audit issue? Absolutely not. We could do that. We'd get out financial statements within a decade, and there would be no problems with that. But that would be the kind of, that's the counterbalance, just like a company goes through when they look at their internal controls, they make cost-benefit analysis. The same thing is true with respect to quality control systems at accounting firms.
Galen Hansen.
I appreciate your comments, Sam, and I'm the same way. When I sign my firm name, it means something to me. But I think most of the people sitting around this table and the people that we deal with feel that way. Also, unfortunately, there's others out there that it might mean more if they were signing their personal name. And I think the concept merits maybe exploration by the board. I wanted to talk also, Ben mentioned we always know who does what on the audit. Some of you know that I'm involved with state boards, and we also have disciplinary matters. And it's really interesting when firms get in trouble and we bring them in, and we see a lot of finger-pointing. You know, I only did this, or, you know, that person was responsible for that. And, I think a certain minimum level of who is doing what might make some sense at some level anyway, because that should never happen. We should always know who's responsible, and the individuals involved should know what their responsibilities are.
Craig Olmstead.
I'd just like to comment regarding Ben's earlier comment. I can tell you, as a CFO who has to sign financials, I have never yet had the view that the engagement partner should also have to sign. And I would tell you that candidly, my own view is that this conversation is really a discussion of form over substance.
Leroy Dennis.
I just want to point out, and again, I can't, like Sam, I can't speak for everybody, every firm's quality control procedures. As it relates to signing the report, I agree it would make no difference in how I sign an opinion. And I also would point out that if you go into our methodology, there are literally hundreds of places where every engagement person on the team signs. They initial every work paper. They sign each section twice. They sign an overall quality control review forms. They sign off on significant adjustments that are passed. They sign off on control areas and an overall conclusion. So there is umpteen places in a file where people sign. I don't think adding one more to the 10K makes a big difference.
Galen, did you have anything else? Yeah, sure. Well, thank you very much for the insightful discussion we've just had for the last 75 minutes. I also want to thank Bill Messier for coming and presenting his thoughts on the subject area. And I will now turn it over to Tom.
Thanks. We actually had the benefit of discussing two topics in that time slot quite thoroughly, I think. So that's quite good. Thanks, Bill. We do appreciate your willingness to come join us today. We're going to break for lunch. We're going to return at 2. We do have lunch for the members of the SAG, the official observers, board members, and members of the PCAOB staff upstairs, I think. Is that correct? Yes.